this episode, we are focusing on the fascinating flavors of our own continent, celebrating African cuisines and exploring new African cuisine. Joining me for this delicious conversation is chef, food writer, and food anthropologist Dr. Anna Trepido, chef Apsa Kokotsoane, local and indigenous food champion, and also from Pru Leith, teaching African cuisine chef Khonse Mai. Welcome, Anna, Khonse, and chef Apsa. We are talking African cuisine today. Can we kick off with everyone's all-time favorite African recipe? That's a big ask. Chef Apsa, it looks like you've already got one.
It's a very good question. It's not an easy one to answer because when you grow up, there's something that you get attached to. And I think traditional chicken, umleqo, it's been something that I've grown up with and I'm so passionate about it. Whether it's been oven baked, whether they slow cook it, then they finish it on the fire, it's just the most incredible thing. I think I just love the broth that comes out of it. Like, I can do so much with it.
You know? It makes the best broth. Absolutely. It's this like, full of flavor, slightly tough, hard body for a reason.
But you know, you grow up, you get sophisticated, you move to new places, and you discover that sorghum is just the new best friend, you know? I'm so in love with sorghum, and I think I cook sorghum for all the clients that I meet. If you come to my house and you didn't eat sorghum, you must know that's a problem. And it's, you know, the what I like as well, it's the diversity of what you can do with it. Mm. It's not only that it can be a normal porridge that you can serve in the morning, but the granules, you can actually do so much out of it. I don't have couscous anymore because I've got sorghum.
Oh, agreed.
I don't have risotto rice. I've got sorghum. I've got millet. I do salads, replacement of rice with sorghum. And you can eat it as many varieties as possible. And those are the two favorite things right now.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. Anna, for you? Is it like asking a mother who her favorite child is?
Yeah, I like lots of things. I'm very greedy. Partly I like seeing patterns. So I like watching, you know, in that same way that with Mediterranean food, you can see that there are core food culture, core ingredients, but that they manifest in different ways. So like Italy is different from Portugal, is different from Palestine, but they are all Mediterranean. I like watching the way that food is the same but different as you move across the continent. So, you know, I'm much more of a sour person than a sweet person, that I really think African ferments are just so delicious and so undervalued that I like watching, if you give a South African an Ethiopian injera, you know, you can see instantly that they recognize that there is a core soured flavor that's quite different from any souredness that you would find in any other part of the world. And I mean, essentially, it's that teff is also a millet. You know, they're both African millets and they've been soured in the same way. So I like those sorts of ferments. I like how funny African food is. So, you know, that whether it be like, somebody told me the other day, you know, those skorpas, those sweeties in Tokoza, when the first RDP houses were built, they were called a skorpaseni because it's like the place of the skorpas because they were very small and they were all painted different colors.
That's
and
brilliant.
It's witty, you know, and you know, like the way that poulet bicyclette is, you know, it's a traditional chicken, but it's been riding a bicycle. You know, it's tough because it's been riding. So I like all those sort of funny little things. And I like, if you're looking for kind of shared characteristics, because obviously these are different food genres, that way that in general, I think all African food has the ability to feel opulent. So in your mouth, you get that kind of rich, I love you feeling that one would get in European food from like cream or butter or, you know, mouth feels like risotto. That a lot of African food it feels very opulent and luxurious, but is not expensive. You know, that this is a continent where people know how to make that I love you without spending a lot of money. But there's definitely a kind of opulent generosity, bigness of generosity, that is not automatically associated with I must spend thousands of rand on caviar.
Exactly.
You know, exactly. Usually it's like, you know, like I was with some Cameroonians the other day and there were about 12 kinds of aubergine in this dish that he made.
Oh, and, heaven.
You know, it just says opulence and abundance in exactly. a way that's not expensive, but is luxurious.
Mm. And can't say your favorite at the moment. I know chefs go through phases.
You know, one of my favorite things to have, and I was always saying that as Africans, our biggest thing is to go back and recreate those recipes of our youth. My personal favorite lately, I don't eat a lot of offal. All right. Cow, no. Lamb, no. But chicken, yes. So my favorite ingredient or my favorite meal right now is literally curry chicken feet and bub.
Yeah. Oh my
so what? My favorite thing about it is that my kids love it, and it's always funny to watch, especially when the little one runs around with one foot and she's just feeding herself this little chicken foot. But chicken feet have been featured in so many ways right now. You find them on the street side, being on a little grill, and they have a basting for them, and absolutely amazing, smoky, spicy, favorite. And it's a takeaway. It's easy to eat as you go. The nutritional value of chicken feet, the collagen in there, it's absolutely amazing. Mm. They make their most amazing soup. We were having chicken feet and pap the other evening. And I said to my mom would look at me. She's like, yo, you're eating chicken feet with a spoon. I was like, you're right. I'm wasting my time. And then I started using my hands. And it's something that for me makes me feel like home. Being in a world with food that is always moving and always changing, sometimes just being back home, being the child that you grew up.
That sounds fantastic. Yeah, I think it's quite ironic that we're spending hundreds of rands buying collagen nowadays. And actually, it's in some of our most, you know, easiest to find and accessible ingredients. And I love the gelatininess, whether it's that or an oxtail or, you know, if it's my lips are sticking together, I love it. Definitely a favorite. Anna, you have really focused your career on African cuisine. In 2006 already, you wrote To the Banqueting House, which I regard as one of the first new African cookbooks. And you've shared with us Nelson Mandela's life through food and also introduced contemporary South Africa to sorghum and millet with Mpotso Kudu in Iteng, just to mention a few of your projects. But why Africa and why African cuisine?
You know, we are all products of our kind of early childhood. I think everybody has to be very careful what they say to their kids because it comes back. But, you know, my parents went into exile in the sort of mid-60s. And so I grew up in a household where everybody was South African. And, you know, genuinely, my father used to play cricket in the park. And, you know, there were a couple of Australians, you know, some people from Jamaica, but there was nobody English. We didn't know anyone English. We never bothered to learn anyone English because, you know, we got told, everybody said in 5 years' time, we'll be home. And the 5 years just kept on kind of getting further and further away. So, you know, when I was a little kid, if we ever did anything in England, my dad would always have a reason why it wasn't quite as nice as the South African version would have been. So you're sitting on the beach in Brighton and he would say, but it's not as nice as Clifton. And he told these stories like about how mangoes were so juicy you had to eat them in the bath. And, you know, we were little kids.
That's not a story.
But we were little kids that had never seen a mango. But so, you know, for me, quite literally, South Africa is the promised land. It was this thing that we were promised. And I am not blind to the issues. But I don't ever shake that kind of like childlike, you know, they weren't lying. In 5 years' time, we were home. And I once read a thing that Celtic monks said about how, you know, this is like medieval monks that, who would like travel long distances. And they would say, you keep traveling until the sky opens up and you're closest to God. And that's where you build your church. And for me, this kind of Johannesburg kind of Transvaal-y environment, so really stretching into what we now think of as the Northwest, you know, that's where the sky opens up and I'm closest to God. So it's not rational, but it's me. So that's why South Africa. That in terms of why African food, it's just, it never occurred to me not to, that it always just seemed puzzling to me that other people weren't interested in African food when A, it was all around us and B, it was so delicious. You know, that what puzzles me, because, you know, like, if you're white, people like give you such a lot of praise for knowing the most basic ingredients and techniques, you know, you get a special pat on the head for that. And you think, well, what's weird is that these other people don't know any of those ingredients. So, I think, you know, objectively, there's a lot of delicious things out there, and it's always seemed really stupid to me not to be in people's pots finding out what they are.
We've just all been, you know, sharing some fascinating sort of memories and passions for our own food. But Anna, why has it taken us so long to celebrate and start celebrating our own continent?
Look, the first thing I want to say is it's got so much better, you know, that we still think it's far away and why is it so appreciated, but it is so much more appreciated than it was 20 years ago, the idea of African cuisine and modern African cuisine. You know, the reason, you know, why it's been underappreciated, you know, there's the obvious things that, you know, colonialism, apartheid, that these are all, you know, forces that are actively separating people, but first from land. And if you don't have land, then you don't get to choose what gets grown. And then all of those sort of cultural forces that tell you that this is not the food, this is not fine food, you know, that which is just, you know, there's, God hasn't given a ruling on what kind of food should be in restaurants, but for a very long time, there was just an assumption that restaurant food was either French or Italian. And then I do think that there's a kind of trauma element that certainly in South Africa, you know, I think more than anywhere else in Africa where for various reasons, people kind of retain their culinary cultural identity to a much greater extent. But especially in South Africa, what trauma has done is mean that people are very protective of food, so that they are quite anxious about innovation, because it feels like it's being disrespectful to granny, and in a way that French people don't feel, that, you know, Nigerians don't feel, that they're not still kind of feeling the need to protect their grandmother. And, you know, they're not wrong that we haven't yet done appreciating traditional in a way that would make people feel that that's not under threat. But if you try fiddling with things, classic things, you know, I don't know, put verjus in chotlo or something, you know, you just have to watch. People get very tense very quickly. So partly it's coming from within, but it's coming from a completely understandable place.
Yes. Chef Absa, how is this new appreciation for all things Africa rolling out in the kitchens of South Africa? Is it a trend, or do you think it's here to stay?
You know, I think taking from what Anna's saying, it's more than a trend. It's taking culture, it's taking respect of ingredients, varieties of it, and putting together in such a way that you still respect the original recipe, the original cooks, our grannies. And when you look at what happens in the kitchen as well, it's the younger you are, the more innovative you become. If you love traditional food and you really, really understand where it comes from, you know, you have a story to tell. Because African food is not just food that you put on the table. It's something that relates to the story. Hence that it falls into its own respect. You put it there and you narrate the story so that you get people educated through what's been put on the plate. When you look at it, there is no way it can go out. Mm-hmm. The innovation is just too much. And I like what you said, Anna, when you said, we need to go back of how things used to be, because that is a history that we don't know. And that's the history that is probably missing to meet the innovation. Because if you know where it's come from and the originality of it, then you know how to manipulate that into innovation stage without losing its originality.
Absolutely. It is the evolution.
Yeah.
You know, it is like we want to innovate on ingredients that we don't understand. And that is actually, I think, where Anna, we have spent a lot of time talking about this process. At Pruleith, we have always had an African curriculum. In the early 2000s.
How
exciting is that?
I honestly get baffled. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a good way that I'm excited. You know, as we become an advocate for traditional food, and the wish it's, can the school also adopt the same thing? You know, we talk about love. You spoke about it comes from the home. It's got a story to tell. Can we continue the story to tell? Maybe it will reduce so much stress in schools because we'll have the mother's energies, positivity in the kitchen.
Mm. We started in the early 2000s. I think I still studied bush cooking at Pruleith. And then, Anna, you did our first Pan-African curriculum, I think, what was it, about 2005. And then a few years ago, is it almost 2 years now, that we looked at that curriculum and we said that we have turned our Pruleith restaurant into a new African, new South African restaurant, contemporary South African. And one of the biggest challenges that we've had has been to get our young chefs and students to innovate with the food that are so familiar and so close to us. And I don't know if it is because it's more difficult to break the rules when you know them so well for a particular food. But we sat together and I said to Anna, I need her to update our curriculum and we need to turn it into a teaching document that helps young chefs understand the different flavors of the entire continent and how to use them and how to put them together respectfully. We were no longer just interested in the history, the traditional ingredients and the recipes. We wanted the how-to of how do we take our homegrown to the future and to the high-end elevated fine dining restaurants. And Khonse, you've been teaching this curriculum now for the past year. How have the students been responding to it and what do you think its value has been?
So my biggest thing is, one, I've been through a Pan-African lecture. And the way I responded to it, I was like, oh, okay, whatever. This is what I've grown up with. However, as I have been teaching it, one, it's exciting for me too. So that has been a very exciting shift in perspective. But how the students are responding is very different. Representation matters. And now the stories are no longer entrenched in, oh, this is why we were eating it. Like you said, there's a lot of background. A lot of our understanding of the food is of the demographics. It's of the situation that was what it was. A lot of the food, like you said, is not expensive. A lot of it was based or birthed out of the need to survive. So the relation of the food is different. When we were growing up, we were still just post-apartheid. Half of the students I'm teaching now have no clue. Apart what? What? What is that? They know about it because they're told about it, but the way they respond to it is different. Because now when you tell them, oh, this is what we eat, they're like, yes, I know that. This is what I've been growing on with my life. And what is happening is that the class is no longer about, this is what African food is. They're now interacting. They're sharing, their stories. They're sharing their memories. They're sharing their childhood. They're sharing all of these things, and now they own it. So it's no longer just about, oh, this is what it is. They take it. They reference it. Representation is such a massive thing right now, to be seen, to be heard, to know that, yes, it is relevant. And we've always known what it is called in our home languages, but now you have the English term to it. So it makes it easier to teach other people, to tell other people, to share your stories in a way that everyone would understand. My biggest thing for me also personally is to see the understanding shifts, to say that, oh, we always love sour things. Or sometimes we even argue, we'll say South African people are vegetarians. We're like, no, we love our meat. Because that's a new construct. What you said earlier was that South Africa has lost so much of its food culture, because we're integrating, we're seeing a lot of cultures coming in. The young people are all about being lit and all of these. But when you're bringing them back to home, they change. They're saying, this is what I've grown up with. And they have a new appreciation for it. Every time we try new things, we get excited. But now you're getting excited about what you've grown up with. It's memories. It's about remembering that soft feeling, that warm hug from the inside to say, this is what I love.
I think the one thing that in teaching the youngsters, you know, obviously they are also new younger generations are far more concerned about health and also the environment and future. And so to bring all of these conversations in together with innovation and to say to them, so this is what you grew up with. How do we take it into the Prulith restaurant in a fine dining environment, and how do we elevate it? And to then see their minds going, this is interesting, this is exciting, and that challenge. But Anna, can you define for us what is new African cuisine, and maybe give an example?
Look, I think we're talking a philosophy rather than a specific technique or a specific ingredient or even a specific chef, that it's about claiming space for African cuisines to be in a fine dining restaurant space. So, you know, where there would be assumptions that only certain sorts of food are restaurant food and other sorts of food are home food. You're claiming space to say this can be luxurious food as well as home food, that it's about finding space for indigenous and heritage ingredients. And that's really saying they have value and the people that created them have value. But that it's not about being in a museum. I think that, you know, that especially like your students, they're chefs, that they are modern world citizens who are also Africans and who are also chefs. And, you know, it's about putting those things together and saying, you know, what does that create? And I think, you know, it's important if you think about any of the new cuisines, whether that's new Nordic or new Andean, what they, you know, if you do them well, what they have the power to do is change perceptions about that base culture. So, you know, that the way people think about Copenhagen is completely different from the way people thought about it 20 years ago. It was just that place where you got not very good cheap pork products. That the same is true of somewhere like Lima, that was just where you went to get kidnapped. And now is, you know, that's got
that
all of these.
That happens to have amazing food.
Yeah. But so potentially there are both tangible and intangible benefits that I think are, I do not understand why, you know, as a nation, as a continent, you know, that we're not investing more money in that at a kind of state level. And I notice actually that in Ghana now, one of the new African cuisine chefs is advertising for interns. And this is a state intern program that when you've been to university in Ghana, you have to do a year's internship, and it has to be in something that's like good for the nation. And for the first time, she's got permission to get have interns who are being funded by the state in her new African cuisine environment.
That can just be great for the nation, never mind good.
Exactly. So that's what we need, is to say this is really valuable. This is a cultural project. This is an economic project. This is a political project. And yeah. It tastes glorious. And that's, you know, that, because if it doesn't taste good, then there's no point. You know, it has to be delicious.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Chef Apsa, this is a world that you have been playing in a lot, but what are the challenges that faces the new African chef when you work in this field?
So I think Khonze already has put that into context. I think one of it, which is accessibility of ingredient. You know, there's a demand and
supply
issue. You know, you put Morocco Atebe on the menu and it's for the next 6 months. Are you able to get that quantities that you need for that whole 6 months? You know, that's still a question. And I think that it's a discussion that we need to sit around the same table with farmers to say, we have planned so much and we have outlined what we want to take what is indigenous South African food to. Are you able to supply? If you are not able to supply, how do we harvest so that we can take through the 6 months? And I think that needs to be a practice that even the young ones, they understand that you can actually dry some of the things. You can preserve some of the things so that it can take you that long. The other thing is, you need to understand what is African food from the cultural perspective. You need to not step into other people's toes. If you go to the northern parts of KZN, there's certain portion of meat that you can't feed to anybody else. You know, they've got specifics. So you need to understand those kind of dynamics, because that can be very challenging. And saying that, when I was in KZN, for the first time I had that, I've always known that that's dumpling. You know, this is dumpling.
Dombolo.
And then you get that side, they say, no, uchek.
And they get quite tense about it.
Yes.
She was adamant that this is not dumpling, this is uchek. And this is how we cook it, and this is how it's supposed to taste. So when you come back, the version that we say this is what we do, it's not the same. But it's understanding those how dynamics to say culture and understanding of it, it plays a major role in what you're going to put on the table. We have a philosophy that you need to present things in such a way that it doesn't go back to the old tricks. Morocco, it's Morocco. But there's so much you can play around with Morocco. But there's so much that you cannot do with Morocco so that you don't disrespect people. So it's either a good or bad kind of thing. But it's how far you're not going to tramp out of the periphery to make sure that you are properly inside. Also, I think it's important to understand and do proper research with how things used to be. Fermentation, I mean, tinya mabele, when it's properly fermented, not the vinegar one that do.
The shortcut.
You know? Because you can taste with the smell that this is not the right one. And that's where the education needs to play a major role, and the excitement that you guys have a curriculum inside. I mean, that is phenomenal, you know? And if that understanding has been planted at that age, it closes the gap of any of these vinegar processes that take place. When you were talking about the students, the interesting thing is all weddings, all funerals, there's nowhere they serve sushi. I've never been to a wedding and there's sushi on the table. There's always tea or that samp or that dumpling, you know, or white pap. And it's as much as we can run away from it, but there are things that are our daily bread, parties, funerals. Our traditional food is always served, whether we like it or not.
You know, and I think we are, I think, more learning to like it. You know, I think that's the whole thing, is not like it, but appreciate it.
Yeah.
You know, like Hanse was saying, sort of going home and understanding the importance of it, not just in terms of the yummy flavor, but also what it sort of means in terms of the sense of occasion, community. And what I really liked, what it comes down to, and that's absolutely what we've experienced, is that it comes down to education.
Yeah.
It comes down to learning. It comes down to, you know, in order to be able to be respectful, you have to make the effort and go and study the subject. You have to go and learn it. You have to go and read something. You have to go and talk to the elders. But, you know, you can't just grab something and start playing with it. You need to get its context. And I think that's very much what we are trying to achieve with our qualification.
And I think, you know, that respect in a culinary space for traditional things means you're having a conversation between past, present, and future, you yeah. know, that where everybody is represented. And in a South African context where, you know, the dead are all around, you know, that and have a voice in the present, that you want those voices to understand that they're being engaged with respectfully, that change or innovation is not about disparaging the original form.
Yeah.
And I think that that is completely possible to do. And I think Absa does it rather well, because he does a lot of weddings, you know, that where things are both authentic and modern. And I think there's not an ancestor in the land that would have a problem with what you've done. Whereas if you think quite often, you know, that in the ancestral realm, offerings are very traditional and, you know, only this way of doing it will do because that's the way people in the past knew it done. That it's as with living people, dead people, if you engage with them respectfully, you know, they are prepared to engage with what you're doing, you know, that nobody's going to think that what you've done is somehow, disparaging people who came before.
Absolutely.
But it's very modern, you know.
And that's actually such a difficult balance.
Yeah, no, it's bloody hard to do.
It's hard, you know, to do.
Which is why people get it wrong so much.
Yeah.
But they also are beginning to get it right more and more.
Yeah.
Hanse, you have gotten it right quite a few times in our restaurant with some really, really fascinating dishes for our Prelith restaurant. What do you love most about playing in the new African space?
We talk a lot about innovation, respect, and all of these things. But what has always been very memorable for me, it's elevation. Elevation of the ingredients, playing with them in a way that you wouldn't have thought about. I remember when we were doing, I think it was our alumni evening, and we were playing about spice blends. And something like mapani worms. Oh, taboo. But mapani worms, I know how they were traditionally eaten. They had to be in a sauce, a tomato sauce, spicy tomato sauce, with morojo. And it has to drip a certain way, etc. But it was in a spice blend. And we were like, it tastes like biltong. And that kind of elevation and innovation, where it's making it accessible and making it presentable and having people going like, what is this? What is this ingredient? And you come and you bring it out and they're like, that is that? Wait a minute, that is that? Allowing people to explore these flavors without having to cringe or without having to fear that this is not going to be presentable. Pushing the boundaries of these ingredients and having to play with it. I remember one of the first things I ever thought about was like, oh, we have to do a 7 colors dish.
Yes.
And we were like, 7 colors. 7 colors is everything to everyone. That is classic South African.
Yeah.
That is in every home. But 7 colors is not 7 colors for every single person. And we were playing around with all of these textures. And we started doing like a fermented sorghum dumpling. So, yes, the dombolo that we would have never used sorghum flour for, we were like, let's push it. We were fermenting it the traditional way.
Yeah.
And you know, sorghum the traditional way, there's a part where it's still fermenting, there's a part where it's rotting. So we needed to know the perfect balance, balancing that, having the texture of a dombolo, the nice soft texture. Are we sharing this plate? This is a share plate. How are we doing it? Chakalaka, the relish of the country. If we don't have a star ingredient or a star dish, chakalaka is in everybody's plate. White, black, it's a braai situation. Everybody loves it, but having it as a puree and those flavors coming through, it is one of the most fun things to see when you go like, okay, I'm going to do this and it works. And that is the beauty of elevation of what we have.
I think a lot of this playing, Khonse, that you're talking about starts with basic tastes. And it's also something that Anna has focused on in our curriculum to try and teach these ingredients to the chefs. And the, you know, these unfamiliar ingredients or sometimes unnerving ingredients like mupani worms. And, you know, in the end of the day, if you go and taste them, it's the most wonderful source of umami.
Mm.
You know, the same as locust beans, in, you know, Nigeria. It's just, you know, and that umami, we understand umami. You know, we might not understand the ingredient, but we understand umami and we understand how it can be used. And the same with sour, with fermentation. And so, you know, I think that that part of that playing is really sort of the basic tastes and learning to taste our food for the first time and think about it.
And learning, you know, what we wanted to do with the course was not teach people to copy, not to be minor birds, to follow a recipe, but to know, you know, what are the core flavors of the different regions and how do they work together? So, you know, yes, we gave students, you know, classic Nigerian recipes, but more than that, we want them, when they're finished, to be able to make something that tastes Nigerian. That's not necessarily anything that's existed before, but is using those flavor combinations in ways that are recognizable. Because I think with a lot of new African cuisine, it looks different on the plate and the ratios might be different. So often there's less starch, you know, relative to other ingredients on the plate. But if you're blindfolded and given a spoonful, you ought to be able to recognize it, you know, that the core tastes must be there. And for instance, I think somebody like Sia Kobo, for instance, the chef, is amazingly good at that, is that he knows how to almost empathize with flavor combinations in a way that he's channeling it. So might look all different, but absolutely his grandmother would know what that was.
I'm absolutely still in love with his dish of the omasi and the whey jellies that he made with the putabop and the different interpretations. Absolutely wonderful. There's so many success stories nowadays, but Anna, as the food critic, what are some of the things that are that you have spotted where this can go wrong? Okay. What do chefs do wrong in this space?
You know, look, first of all, it's really hard. It's easy to criticize and it's very hard to do. So that's point number one. And I think, and anybody that's trying, you know, that in itself is a good thing. What you don't want is just like somebody that's done, you know, this, their kind of bog standard restaurant sort of francophone thing and put a lump of speckboom on the top. That you don't want it to just be garnish. You want there to be a real engagement with flavors. It's not just, yeah, you know, creme brulee that has got buchu in it. You know, that's, I think that that's a key issue that, you know, other than that, I like food where people have given something of themselves. So, you know, that feels honest. So if it's a bit showy off, and that's almost like a protective thing, I think that that's not useful. But on the whole, I think often when people get it wrong, it's not necessarily the chef's fault. It's, you know, that you have to, these are businesses. That will the customer buy what you, you know, your most sort of authentic, innovative self? do your kitchen have the skills to produce it? Can you get the ingredients? You know, there's a whole lot of things that block chefs from being this kind of perfect, new African chef. And I think often foreign chefs within the new Nordic and new Andean cuisine, you know, that they tell young South African chefs, oh, you must be yourself all the time. And of course, that's what you should be. But, you know, they are in a context where, for instance, there's state funding for that kind of research into indigenous ingredients, where there's a receptiveness in the audience who haven't had 200 years of being told that their cultures are less important, you know, that the audience, you cannot make it if the audience won't buy it. And often, you know, part of what you're doing as a new African chef is creating an audience that will then appreciate your food. And that's much harder. If you start an Italian restaurant, people are very familiar and they come to it with a kind of willingness and positivity that you have to build if you're a new African chef.
That's very, very true, Anna. And I think we've seen that in a lot of our African projects, is that you have to absolutely convince and prove to people that it's got value in order for them to buy into it. But Khonse, as chefs, we are very much focused on creating our delicious food. And we've now had a wonderful discussion about, you know, sort of the wonderful culture and all of the things that are delicious around this. But what are the broader benefits of our, for our industry and of chefs cooking in new African cuisine?
With the way the world is working now, one of the biggest things is sustainability. Shopping local, making sure that the ingredients are local. First and foremost, if not great for the economy, it is also great for the environment. Secondly, the economy. When we support more local products, it is coming back to the economy. So we are now making sure that we're creating jobs. We're talking about the economy shrinking all the time. That's all you ever hear on the news. But we don't support enough of our own. So local farmers, we talked about sourcing ingredients, etc. If the farmers know that they will have a customer base for these products, where we have indigenous products being grown locally, that is going to help our economy grow. We're having the tourism aspect of it. We also have people who now have food that is present, that is timely, that is now. Foreigners or everybody coming, touring the country, they don't want to have their old pizza that they're going to criticize, or spaghetti that was broken that is going to make them cringe or any of those things. They want to have an experience. Now our tourism is coming in. We are now having more and more restaurants by younger chefs, by old chefs coming and integrating the two. We're talking about innovation, renewing, appreciation, creating all of that buzz for the country as well to say you have to go to South Africa. We talk about some areas in the world where people are going there for culinary journeys. People must come here for culinary journeys.
Absolutely.
And it's not just about being in Soweto or being in a certain place. It has to be accessible with the hotels. It has to be accessible in the restaurants. Through that, it will filter in everywhere else.
And it's happening, as you said in the beginning, Anna, as though it's far away, but actually it is happening. There are those chefs that are setting that example. And so I would like you to name the chefs, your favorite new African chefs that we need to be watching, following, stalking on Instagram, the ones that our young students should be looking to for inspiration, other than our own two great examples here. Chef Upsa?
Sure. People must not beat me up. So, you know, that chef that don't have restaurants, but they do such incredible work, and they don't get enough recognition. That's why I don't like the awards scenarios. But I love, you know, Sia has made any significant value of what and who we are. And his contribution to the Olympics. And it's just, that's a tragedy that they don't believe enough on traditional food to take it to the Olympics.
That will change. It will have to.
And for me, you have such an incredible human mind that's able to change simple things, still giving you the old flavor, but giving you a new interpretation of what 2024 is.
Mm.
And he's still not getting that recognition. But apart from that, you have people who are now adapting indigenous food into their restaurant. The new one, Gigi's, Moses.
Mm-hmm.
Moses is really growing day by day, introducing indigenous food in the restaurant. And what I saw, I think it was yesterday, they were eating giblets, chicken giblets. Oh. And I was like, that's exactly what I want to go and eat, you know, because that gets you excited. But that gets you excited because it's got memory. It tells a story. It takes you back. You know, you remember your childhood. You remember the songs you were singing. You know, it fills your tummy so well and so comfortable because it's a huge memory and a journey that's leading you back.
And it fills the heart.
Absolutely.
Which I think is even more important. Khonse, for you, who are you following and spying on for ideas and inspiration?
I feel like it's bias because I actually do know Sia. And I've always been in awe because when we were introduced to the junior team, he was one of the few people I was really, really looking because he is such a skillful man. It's hard to understand because if you do not know him, you do not know what he offers. And he had for a little bit a pop up and then COVID happened and obviously it derailed him a little bit, but he is definitely one to watch. I think he's actually not the one to watch. He is the standard for some of us. And a lot of us think, oh no, it's just about Amasi. No, it's not. He has literally, like you have said, put a plate together that is respectful, innovative, elevation. That is everything that we want in African food. Vusi Ndlovu, my friend, also, I've met him through team, but what he's been doing, we've been playing around. I remember one of the competitions we did, and I think you're underestimating how much African cuisine has actually gotten into the competition space. Because years ago, I think it was 2013, we were making things like rooibos mayonnaise. We were making Amasi emulsions. All of those things way, way back then, they were not properly recognized or given the proper platform, but those were already creeping into the competition space. Yes, we're not saying this is Poto, etc., Grimmelpap, Crisp, whatever it is, but that has already filtered in. And yes, change is slow, but it's happening. Again, I feel like this is another biased one, but Chef Katala Langole in Zambia, my favorite. I love that little man. He's a big man. He's big, but he's one of the few people that I always feel like he's relevant.
Yeah.
He's recognizable. He's accessible. And he is visible representation. Things that we need. I always love stalking his Facebook reels, simple ingredients. And he is literally making waves. The other day, he was just being recognized as some of the young men or men in Zambia, 100 men who are making waves and changes. And that is great because chefs are not only representation. We always like to say, oh, we just cook. No, we're not. We change makers.
Mm.
We change laws. We can make a lot of noise and through food. And those are some of the people who've been making a lot of noise.
I think what I love about Chef Kat Khonse is that he is having so much fun doing this.
Absolutely.
You know, sometimes we're very serious when we do this and we feel a huge responsibility, but somehow he is just doing this with so much fun. Like, he is turning Chikanda into the most interesting things and crazy things at times. But yeah, definitely very exciting.
And he's very,
very
generous as well. Yes. You know, that he's very willing to share.
Absolutely.
And, you know, he doesn't sort of privatize knowledge.
And now everyone has mentioned men. But I know that there are fabulous women in this space. Who would you recommend we follow?
Well, I'm first going to start with a man, I'm afraid, is that I am just besotted with Nigerian chef Michael Elegabede and his Yoruba mythology menu. Feels to me like it does everything that we're talking about. You know, just I am such a fan, it's almost embarrassing. I love the work Catherine Adonis, who's the pastry chef at the Saxon, who I think, you know, pastry is such a technical art, and in lots of ways is quite foreign to quite a lot of parts of Africa, not all Africa, but quite. She takes African indigenous ingredients into places that I have never thought of. That she made a Shigugu chocolate tart with it was a sorghum shortbread base. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that crumble, that shortbread has anyway, but that sorghum, even ground sorghum, has a slight texture to it that's just different from wheat. So I think that she is very, very creative in the pastry space. That, in Ghana, Selassie Atadika, I love her work. Chef Binta, obviously, I think that one of the things that new African chefs have, you know, had to do of necessity, and in a way was true for all chefs, the Nordics do it as well, but especially true for Africa, is that if you want these heritage ingredients that have been so marginalized, then you have to support farmers in creating them, that you can't expect them just to be in the shop tomorrow because they aren't, you know, and Chef Binta, you know, and Pierre Cham as well with Fonio, mm-hmm. that, you know, that you need to create spaces in which farmers can thrive. And that's just because this is a new genre and one has to do that. So I think Chef Binta is amazing. Yeah, I think those are my favorites. Michael Elegabede, my heart belongs to him, I have to say.
I think it's good that this is not and a video. Sia. I think you're blushing.
You know, Sia Kobo goes without saying, you know, yeah, he's absolutely I love local him, hero. But yeah. Michael Elegabede and that Yoruba heart. Menu.
So
clever.
I think I'm going to make your day.
Yes.
She had a restaurant in Cape Town, and she was incredible.
Of course she was. I know who you're talking about.
Yeah. But you know, for me, what was interesting, it's the menu was written in Zulu.
Mm.
And for that, I will always love her. Because she put herself first, where she come from, then you can read the English version later.
And you know why I love her so much? Is because Garde Manger is my subject in my happy place, working with all the wobbly bits and the offal that Honse didn't like. And so the amount of offal that she had on her menu just like made me just love her even more. Absolutely fantastic. This has been an absolutely wonderful conversation. Delicious. And we are all from South Africa around this table. But I would like us to think about dishes or ingredients that are not traditional to South Africa that make you happy and that you think the rest of the world should celebrate more?
The one that I really love, it's popular.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if you go to an authentic and original, I'm not sure if original is a good word to use, but someone who's been to Nigeria and somebody has been cooking with grannies and stories behind the whole dish, jollof rice.
Oh, agreed.
I don't know what to do, but I'm in love with jollof rice. I think I appreciate it, especially because when I met the Nigerian friend of mine, and he was telling me the story when the grandmother, they were migrating from a village to another area, and that was the only surviving dish that carried them from moving from one village to another one. Mm. And the stories the grandmother was saying around how they actually cooked it, that story stuck with me for the longest time. So if I have to put anything on the table, that will be jollof rice.
And, you know, I'm so glad it's got a wonderful story, but in my house, it is just the best braai side nowadays. Everyone's just referring to it as your spicy rice. And that is just, I couldn't agree more.
But, you know, the beautiful thing about being African, we don't just do things. We've got stories. There is a reason for why we're here. There is a reason why we eat what we eat.
Mm.
There is a story that backs up why that is being done, you know, so it's not just a jollof rice. There is no way.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Concept?
I love fish. Africans have been doing fish for a very long time. Besides the smoking and the drying and all of these things, tibujin, aharaimi, all of these ingredients, like we're celebrating fish. I don't know, it's weird, like the Mozambican prawns, bilibili prawns. You know, things that we wouldn't always, inland, especially in South Africa, always have, are being celebrated and being put on tables every time. And I'm really enjoying that. And then just for an honorable mention, kukupaka. One of my favorites, because this, oh my goodness, I've always loved it. And when I do cook it, and I always say to my mom that this is kukupaka, she's like, no, it's curry chicken. I'm like, no, 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 it's not. This is kukupaka. And I'll tell her all the stories behind it. Well, for me, the journey of how I made it, and I appreciate it. The spices, the spice blends, all of these things that are happening. And also, more than anything, and I know we're seeing the pastes and everything in the, on the shelves and everything, just some of the spice blends that we have coming out of North Africa. Amazing.
Oh, stunning. Anna?
And I think you've made a good point about, you know, essentially kukupaka is a, it's a fusion food. And, you know, there are so many interesting fusion foods that, you know, quite often get kind of associated with the motherland. So people say it's Indian food or it's Portuguese food. Mm. And you think, no, it's not. This is a food that was born in Africa that is a fusion of different peoples, whether that be Piri Piri or, you know, Durban Indian or, you know, any of those kind of fusion creations. That I think that, that for one thing, as tourist attractors, those fusion foods which do have one foot in another culture are very accessible, and they're often a first step in for people that are unfamiliar with African flavors, and that I think we shouldn't exclude those from the conversation. My heart, I suppose, belongs to Central Africa. Mm-hmm. I love West African food. I love how generous it is, how ebullient it is. I love that base that comes out of, you know, that jollof, you know, that start off, that's the ginger and the garlic and the Scotch bonnet chili and the tomato, obiata. That yeah. Obiata base, you know, just magnificent wherever you take it from there. But I like the gentlest subtlety of Central African food. So I think, you know, some kind of liboke would be my death row meal. So something steamed. Yeah, again, I think aubergines. I think that Central Africa's great contribution are those multiple kinds of aubergines, the little tiny ones, the purple ones, the white ones, you know, just so many different aubergines. So a steamed something, some sort of liboke would be my last meal.
Green bananas. My travels into East Africa and Central Africa and Rwanda specifically, I have fallen in love with them. We don't get them here often. And whether I've had them in Mutori as a wonderful comforting soup, or whether the local hotel is trying to be modern and fry them up and serve them with guacamole, or I've also had them in a wonderful light tomato sauce just braised, it is like a hug. I love that. To me, it is such a wonderful comfort food. This continent has got amazing flavors, and I can't wait to explore them more going forward. Thank you.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.